This is Judaism Unbound, episode 43, Hanukkah in America. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
We're here today with Professor Diane Ashton. She is a professor of religion studies at Rowan University. Professor Ashton is here as part of our arc exploring the holiday of Hanukkah. She literally wrote the book on this subject. Her book, called Hanukkah in America, A History, is a fascinating exploration of the evolution of this holiday in America. We're going to be talking about it with her today, and we're certainly going to be looking in the next few weeks at this question of how has Hanukkah evolved in the past, and how might it be evolving in the present, and what might happen to it in the future. Clearly, Hanukkah is becoming a more significant holiday in American Judaism than it ever was before, and we are very excited to welcome Professor Diane Ashton to help walk us through how that came to be. So, Professor Ashton, thank you so much for joining us on Judaism Unbound. It's a pleasure to have you.
I'm so happy to be here.
Great. So we thought we'd just get started initially with the question of how you came to write a history of Hanukkah in America.
I've always been very interested in American Jewish life. That's what I've chosen to write about for my career. But I've always been very amused and fascinated by the permutations and new ways Jews have decided to work with Judaism in the U.S. to have it become a way to express not only their traditional religious perspectives, but their perspective on American life and the way that their views of the world have been absorbing the ideas from general American culture. And holidays are a way for people in any religion to kind of express their current emotions, values, hopes. Holidays are celebrations that are composed of not only very traditional elements, but also very spontaneous popular culture kinds of elements. And that combination is fluid, particularly in the United States, it's very fluid. And so that makes holidays very interesting to me. And Hanukkah, I think, is the most fascinating of Jewish holidays because of that, because so much of it happens at home. Then people are quite free to shape it into something that is really most meaningful for themselves and their families. And so I think it really reflects a lot of ways Jewish life changes and becomes more meaningful in different ways. And I just find it very fascinating.
Well, I think that there's this sense that a lot of people tend to have that a lot of elements of Judaism, although they may have had some small changes, they've remained largely static over time. And it seems from your book that that's not really the story of Hanukkah in America. And I was wondering if, just as a beginning point, you could start to walk us through the story of Hanukkah in America, starting from, you know, well, what did the American Jewish community inherit from, I suppose, Europe, where most of the early American Jews came from? And then how did it begin to reshape itself in a new way in America in the early years?
The bones of Hanukkah, the traditional bones of Hanukkah, are actually not very complicated. The Talmudic instructions for lighting the candles and the blessings that are to be said have been in place for hundreds of years, and that's the basic bones of it. You light these candles in the evening at sundown. You do it in your home. And on the Sabbath of Hanukkah in the synagogue, there is a special portion that is read from the book of Zechariah, and a special prayer thanking God for miracles that God performed for Jews when the temple was reclaimed from the Assyrians. And the Maccabees are considered to be the leaders of that revolt, and so they're the heroes of Hanukkah. But there's this tremendously interesting tension that's always existed, as far as I can tell, between the rabbinic construction of the blessings, which thank God for the miracle of the victory over the Assyrians and being able to reclaim the temple and rededicate it to God, the ancient temple in Jerusalem. So crediting God with everything, versus the kind of hero worship of the Maccabees, the people who led this revolt. Is it a human victory? Is it a divine victory? There's this tension in Hanukkah that goes back to the beginning. And that, I think, is something that emerges in America in very interesting ways as something that becomes how you can identify different branches of Judaism by how they talk about and how they credit these two different sources for the victory.
Well, there's a famous story in my wife's family that during World War II, they lived, my mother-in-law and her mother and family lived in Columbia, South Carolina. And her mom had grown up in Charleston. And during the war, when my mother-in-law's father was off in Europe fighting the war, my wife's grandmother, who had grown up Orthodox in Charleston, had a essentially celebrated Christmas at home. They had stockings. I don't think they had a tree, but they had stockings and various kind of Christmas type celebrations. And some of her relatives came over and were totally scandalized that she was celebrating Christmas. And she said, well, you know, the kid's father's off fighting the war and they're really sad. And we wanted to create something happy for them. And many years later, my wife asked her grandmother, why didn't you celebrate Hanukkah? I mean, why did you think that the only way to have this happy experience would be to celebrate Christmas? And she said to her that basically Hanukkah didn't exist at that time in any serious way that would make anybody happy. You know, there was some business with lighting the candles and maybe a couple of cents of guilt, and that was about it. And it certainly wasn't going to make the kids happy. And I'm wondering if that's accurate as, in terms of the story of Hanukkah in America up till the war, that it really was an extremely minor thing.
It was an extremely minor holiday. Yes, the Talmud relegates both Hanukkah and Purim to being minor festivals. Purim was the much more festive occasion. People would dress up. There'd be obviously costume parties, and you make humantashen, and you make a lot of noise when you hear the Megillah reading. And that was the big festive occasion in the Jewish calendar among these two minor festivals. Hanukkah was almost an afterthought. It was not a big deal. In Eastern Europe, one thing that would happen during Hanukkah that was very unusual and more festive, because the passage of Zechariah that's read in the, during Sabbath Hanukkah in the synagogue says, sing and rejoice, concerts became associated with Hanukkah, musical concerts, and synagogues do not have instrumental music, and this has been since the, at least Orthodox synagogues, and this has been since the destruction of the temple, and it's a sign of our still being in mourning for the destruction of the temple. But because of that passage in Zechariah, and because I think also because Hanukkah celebrates the rededication of that temple before its final destruction, in Eastern Europe there was this custom of having concerts, instrumental concerts, musical concerts in the synagogue at Hanukkah. And so music becomes associated with Hanukkah. But if your wife's family were not from Eastern Europe, they wouldn't have that musical association with Hanukkah, because that's really more of a folk custom than, you know, the Talmudic tradition.
On this question of the place that Hanukkah once held and eventually becoming a bit more elevated, I was fascinated in your book when you looked at the era of the mid to late 19th century, and there's just a really fascinating variety of phenomena that seem to start happening. And it seems like everybody, regardless of their agenda or what their theological beliefs are, is sort of latching on to the story of Hanukkah and to the Maccabees to prove their case. And I'm curious if you can expand on that.
Yeah, I thought this was really fascinating myself. So we have to look at the 19th century in the U.S., and there's the Civil War. So we have a century in which you have, you know, the War of 1812, and then you have Indian Wars, and then you have the Civil War, and then you have more Indian Wars. So the militarism of the 19th century is so embedded in American culture, and it's so vividly a part of American culture, and military virtues of heroism and bravery and devotion really become very valued. What do Jews have? How many occasions in the Jewish calendar are there where we can look to a reason to speak of military values? Not too many. But Hanukkah there certainly is. And so you have Isaac Meir Wise, who was very ambivalent about Hanukkah. As a reformer, he thought the whole thing about miracles was something, you know, that you spoke about to children, but certainly not to adults. And Hanukkah was about rededicating the temple in Jerusalem, and reformers were not interested in ever going back to having the temple in Jerusalem restored. That really was not part of the reform approach to Judaism at all. And yet, he writes this long, ongoing, serialized novella about the Maccabees that's published weekly for 39 weeks in his journal, his newspaper, the American Israelite. He edits the journal and he writes this story. And he retells the story of the Maccabees in a way that shows the values of 19th century America, both the militarism, the heroism, the concern for bravery and devotion, but also the Victorian attitudes that were being embraced in 19th century America. So we have a lot of women in this story. We have women who are devoted to helping the soldiers, and the idea of religious devotion among women becomes very important, because this is what's happening in America in 19th century, in general American culture. Women are becoming more associated with religion for a variety of reasons we're not going to go into here. But it's an interesting realignment that happens among American Jews as well, that they are bringing this respect and new regard for the Maccabees, and a sense that women are especially, and by nature, religious people. So it's an interesting change in the way Hanukkah is talked about. And, of course, there's this huge battle between rabbis and religious leaders among Jews, between people who are promoting the new reforms and people who are totally opposed to Reform Judaism. And each one of these people sees themselves as Maccabees, people who are fighting to save Judaism. Are you saving it by reforming it, or are you saving it by maintaining tradition and fighting the reformers? With the arguments and the warfare and the new literature and newspapers that is going on in the 19th century, the Maccabees become heroes that are much more broadly understood as Jewish heroes, more so than they had been in the past.
It's so interesting because, you know, I think about the rabbis, the early rabbis project, in a way being driven by the opposite point of view, where they weren't big fans of the Maccabees because of, I think, seeing the Maccabees as having become corrupted or Hellenized over time, and then also by the Maccabees perhaps representing the militarism that ultimately caused the destruction of the temple. And the rabbis sort of took Hanukkah in a way away from the Maccabees and focused on the miracle and on the lights and the menorah staying lit and everything. And this is a story about how, you know, nearly 2,000 years later, the Maccabees are coming back into the center of the story, because now the concern is that we don't believe in miracles in the same way.
Even later on, later in the century, and then in the 20th century, when the question about miracles is not quite as in the forefront, it's still the interest in the Maccabees and the value for the bravery of actual Jews, because of the kinds of things that Jews have to withstand in the 20th century, that continues to be very important. And so the Maccabees continue to be heroes. And Jews, American Jews, continue to feel that this is a really important thing to recall about Jewish history, and that there have been Jews who fought and fought successfully. This is certainly important to the Zionists. The early Zionist movement claimed Hanukkah as their key holiday up until the start of the State of Israel, when they had their own Independence Day. But before that, Hanukkah was the Zionist holiday.
And during this period when the reformers are reconceptualizing Hanukkah in the way that you've described, and when the Zionists are seeing Hanukkah as kind of their most resonant ideological holiday, is the practice of Hanukkah changing, or is the practice more or less what it had been, which was relatively minimal?
The practice changes in an interesting way because of changes in American holidays. So in the second half of the 19th century, American society is creating holidays like mad. 25 new holidays emerge between the middle of the 19th century and the turn of the 20th century for all kinds of things. Many of them disappear. But one of the dynamics that we see going on with this is that children become a focus more than they had been previously for domestic life and for religious life. American culture begins to see children as innocent and safe repositories for adult emotions. It would be a safe thing for an adult to invest a lot of emotion into a child because the child won't hurt them. The child can be trustworthy. And so that becomes a focus for these emotional events among families, family holidays that develop, domestic holidays that develop in the 19th century, like Thanksgiving becomes this domestic occasion that occurs every November, and Christmas becomes a domestic holiday in a way that it hadn't been previously. We see a similar thing happening with Hanukkah. The first iteration of this does not happen in households. It happens in a synagogue in Cincinnati, where the Reform movement is really led by two rabbis, Isaac Meir Wise and Max Lilienthal. And Max Lilienthal was a terrific rabbi who was really beloved, and he cared a great deal about children and children's education and Jewish education. And he had been asked to speak in a church in Cincinnati, and he noticed that they had these events for their children to bring the children into church specifically for occasions for them. He said, "We're not doing this with our kids." The Reform movement's changes were so focused on adults and being rational that they really were not attracting a lot of interest among their children. And so Lilienthal said, "We need to start bringing children into the synagogue for special occasions for them." And so Hanukkah became the first one that he did. And it was a Hanukkah, it was sort of a pageant. There was music, they lit the candles, and the kids were given something sweet to eat at the end of it. Candy and I think oranges were a big deal at that time, being able to get oranges in December. This festival for children at Hanukkah in synagogues was a new creation that they did, but both Lilienthal and Wise had national newspapers, and they publicized this event in their newspapers and urged every congregation around the country to do this and to write into the newspapers and tell us how you did your festival. Because it was a new creation, people could kind of create it in the ways that they liked, that fit their local community interests and abilities and talents. The other thing that's happening by the last few years of the 19th century is Christmas has become a national holiday, and it's become a national holiday in the way that we would recognize it, with department stores having special sales and displays, with sheet music being sold for Christmas songs, and shopping being something that becomes part of the Christmas experience, and gifts for children at Christmas being something that is sort of a national event by the last couple of decades of the 19th century. And Jews are doing that too. Remember, in the 19th century, we have many more Jews coming from Central Europe, from Germanic territories, than from Eastern Europe. And in Germanic territory, Christmas was this domestic occasion. We get a lot of our Christmas customs from them, the trees, the gifts, Santa Claus. So this was something that a lot of American Jews did. They may have done it in addition to Hanukkah, but it was not something that was really foreign to them.
Would you say that Hanukkah did take on a certain new form in the 20th century, or would you say that it was really just an extension of what you've just described? And I'm wondering if you see it evolving in a certain way now in the early part of the 21st century that may be distinct in one direction or another, I guess.
Hanukkah began getting its the familiar shape that we would see it very early in the 20th century. Once you get advertising and promoting of gifts for kids at Hanukkah, which you get by the turn of the 20th century in Jewish newspapers, that's going to be a familiar Hanukkah that we could all look at it and say, oh yeah, we know what that is. But at the same time, you have other things that go on in different eras throughout the 20th century that reflect people's use of Hanukkah to speak to particular things that are happening to them in each era. So clubs in the 1920s, when there's a tremendous rise in anti-Semitism and anti-foreign, anti-immigrant sense in the U.S., we see lots of plays and skits for kids at Hanukkah that are performed in clubs and in religious schools to kind of strengthen them in their devotion. And here again, we see that Maccabees become really important heroes that are being told to children and to adults in adult clubs. People are performing these skits. We see that happening in the 20s and the 30s. In the 40s, during World War II, we see the Maccabees again becoming these heroes and these people that we can look to say, Jews defended themselves, and that's really and did so successfully, and we should remember that. In the 50s and 60s, as Jews moved to the suburbs, we get an increasing concern about Christmas in schools. This is something that has been a concern for Jews since the Eastern European immigrants came in the early 20th century. We see them in the 1900s. We see people keeping kids out of school when there's Christmas stuff going on. But when Jews are in the suburbs, they start a coordinated effort to get Christmas out of school activities in a very concerted way and to go take it to the Supreme Court and to get Christmas decorations out of the public square and off City Hall property. So this becomes sort of the general approach that American Jews take as an organized community to get nativity scenes and Christmas decorations out of the courthouses, municipal halls, and certainly the public schools. And they win this battle. And this has been a particularly strong sort of general conviction among American Jews for decades in the 20th century that there should not be religious emblems in public territory, and certainly not influencing our children. This changes in the 1970s when the Lubavitcher Hasidim take an entirely different approach to things, and they say completely the opposite. They say, America is not going to stop you or any of us from displaying our Hanukkah menorahs. If other people are putting up trees and nativity scenes, why can't we display our religious symbols as well? Because Chabad wants to bring, you know, they're a missionary group, and they want to bring Jews to more Jews to more Orthodox observance. And so they use Hanukkah as a way to kind of get Jews out of the shadows and get them to be more likely to embrace Hanukkah, a happy occasion. This is entirely opposed to the approach that Jews have taken about religious symbols in December for decades. But it's very interesting to me. It's been very interesting to me to watch how comfortable people have become with this very different approach. The other kind of thing that's been going on is intermarried families. The number of intermarried families has grown dramatically in the last few decades. And that is another fascinating dilemma, a different kind of December dilemma for American Jews. they make their own solutions for how they're going to run their family's holiday celebrations. It often depends on what the particular parent wants to have happen. What do they feel strongly about? What kind of memories do they have? What do they want to instill in their children? What do the grandparents think? How much do they get involved in the family's life? Are they living in a community with a lot of Jews or very few Jews? So it's all very individualistic for intermarried families.
On that front, quick anecdote. My fiance isn't Jewish, and we have a great connection to both Hanukkah and Christmas. And I think it was embodied when we went, and also embodies the commercialism you spoke about, when we went and purchased for our cat, who we joke is Buddhist, so that we're a tri-religious household. We bought our cat a little Hanukkah shirt with a dreidel logo and his name on it, and also a little Santa Claus outfit. And he wore both proudly last year.
Didn't
like us so much
for it.
But shifting gears to a different question, we've spoken about the massive variety of ways that different groups have been able to take Hanukkah and apply it to their own worldviews in fascinating ways that also incorporate the dynamics of the broader societal context. I'm curious if you can expand on some of the reasons why that is so easy to occur. And I'm thinking particularly in your book, you spoke about sort of four main ways that Hanukkah really lends itself to enhanced observances today and to a sort of flexibility. And I'm curious if you can talk about that a little and why Hanukkah of all holidays is able to take on this flexibility in ways that maybe other holidays haven't as much.
Certainly, I think the key thing is that it happens at home. People are not coming into your house to monitor how you're doing things. And there's a lot of freedom if something goes on in your home. And it isn't even, and it's also such a simple holiday. I mean, Passover goes on in our homes, but there's a Haggadah. And certainly we can choose to use it or not. People rewrite the Haggadah. But Hanukkah is so simple. So that's really the second thing. It's in your home. It's very simple. Anybody can do it, really. It's, you know, you light candles. It's only a few small blessings. It's over within 5 minutes. The ritualized part of it is over within 5 minutes. And so then you can do whatever you like. You can add, and because it happens at sundown on a cold winter evening, and I'm assuming it's cold because it's always cold where I live. You know, obviously there are people who live in warm climates, and I always envy them by the time it gets to be Hanukkah. But, you know, it's dinner time. So it's a family gathering. You can have special foods with it very easily. And the potato pancake, is the latke, has become the food from Eastern Europe because anybody could afford a latke. It's just, you know, potatoes, flour, egg, salt and pepper, and oil. That's it. That's a latke. Anybody can afford that. And so it became this simple meal that anybody could make, became a special food. And so you have all these little elements that make it easy to elaborate on. And just as important as it being in your home, it's a joyous holiday. It's a happy occasion. There's every indication that Hanukkah would have become a popular event in the U.S. among American Jews. But then you put it in December, and there's just no way Hanukkah would not become a happy, popular event because you have increasingly all of American culture, as long as it's been this, you know, commercialized, capitalist, consumer economy that we have, there's just no way to avoid the pressure that comes from the general culture to create a domestic happy occasion in your home in December.
I've joked for many years that one day, you know, every Jew is going to have a tree in their house during Hanukkah, and we'll tell the story that when the Maccabees rededicated the temple, they planted a tree outside.
And that's why we have a tree for Hanukkah.
You know, but that's how it goes. That's exactly how
right.
It goes. You know, as soon as somebody writes a book that's used in a religious school that creates this mythology, that's going to go. It's going to become, I was raised with that, and that'll become the truth.
When we think about Hanukkah moving forward, I'm thinking about the fact that it doesn't seem to me that either in America or in terms of the relationship that I think a lot of American Jews have towards Israel, that this idea of the Maccabees, the fighting Jew, is going to be something that has tremendous resonance going forward. And it also doesn't seem that many of at least the secular American Jews today are going to have a lot of excitement about the idea of a miracle. And so I'm wondering if both of the kind of traditional points of view about the origin and the meaning of Hanukkah don't have resonance, and yet the home-based dimension of it that you described in the winter festival and the idea that we are going to want at least some Jewified version of Christmas for various reasons. Is that the kind of situation that potentially gives rise to some new meaning of Hanukkah that might emerge or that is emerging?
Well, I think there certainly can always be a new meaning attached to Hanukkah. But one of the things that I have learned as being a historian, I never predict the future. Particularly with seeing the way, with religion, how religion is always applied in new ways, always new meanings are always found for religious traditions. Judaism has been around an incredibly long time, and you would have thought that it would have died out a long time ago. But no, people are always finding new meanings in Judaism to bring it meaningfully into new historical situations. And I think that the Maccabees can be talked about in a lot of different ways. Anytime Jews are going to be under attack or feeling threatened, the image of heroes who were successful in defending themselves are going to be useful ideas, emotionally useful, if not actually useful. I think there's a lot of fluidity, and that fluidity makes it very likely that the holiday will continue to be adapted to future situations, and its meaning may be told in different ways, just as in the 19th century people talked about the Maccabees in different ways than they talked about the Maccabees in the 1940s. But they still had this idea of the Maccabees as Jews who were heroes who successfully defended themselves.
I've been trying to resist from asking this, but I just can't hold back anymore. And I'm asking about what I think is probably the most contentious issue of Hanukkah. Nobody, as far as I know, has fought on a battlefield over it, but it's how do we spell it? How in the English language should we spell this holiday of ours? And I noticed that in your book, and first off, your book's title is Hanukkah in America, and it goes with the spelling H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H for those who haven't read the book. But you also have a really interesting section that speaks about how that spelling issue has played out and how certain groups have gone with different spellings that reflect different things about them. And I'm curious if you could talk about that.
Okay, so the big problem with the spelling of Hanukkah is that there's no chet in English. So how do you signify a sound that doesn't exist in the language you're using? So people have done this basically two different ways, either with a ch, which in English is the sound of a chair, which is not Hanukkah, or with a dot under the h, just to let people know it's not really an H sound that you should be making. So in both cases, you're spelling Hanukkah in a way that only signals to people who already know how to spell, how Hanukkah is supposed to sound. And you're just signaling to them that you too also know that Hanukkah begins with a sound that does not appear in English. But for people who don't already know that, the CH is very misleading, and the dot under the H is just confusing. So for the title of the book, I just used Hanukkah, as you described it, because it was the spelling that was used in the New York Times, I think it was 1882, And so that spelling has become an American tradition itself. And the New York Times is sort of an authority for American life, I think, in some cultures, some part of American culture. And so if it's good enough for the New York Times for all this time, I think it's that's the way I want to go.
So I'm just curious, as we come towards the close of our time, are there ways that you think that this analysis of Hanukkah or thinking about Hanukkah is a lens through which we can think about, I know you don't want to predict the future, but in terms of thinking about taking alternative courses that maybe are passed in one area, specifically Hanukkah, opens up for other directions that we might take and other holidays and other aspects of Jewish life. You know, I'm just thinking, like, in my head, as we were talking earlier about Purim, you know, if the difference between Hanukkah and Purim, or one of the differences between Hanukkah and Purim, is that Hanukkah traditionally takes place in the home and Purim doesn't, you know, maybe the move that we really should be exploring is to try to develop home-based rituals for Purim, because those would be much more likely to be embraced. And I'm wondering if that's, you know, whether you might have any thoughts as a historian on things that those of us who are working on trying to help Judaism find its way in the next iteration of American life ought to know about or ought to be thinking about that we might not naturally be thinking about.
I think that's a really interesting point. I think it couldn't hurt to develop home-based rituals for Purim. Unfortunately, you're doing it at a time when home life is really kind of fracturing in some ways, in that people are incredibly busy and working lots of different odd hours and traveling, and home is becoming, in interesting ways, more valued and more precious as it's being pressured to, you know, because that time at home is really becoming less predictable than it has been in previous eras of American history. But, you know, this is exactly what happened in the 19th century. That's why we got domestic festivals in the 19th century, is factories opened and men, you know, male labor left homes and farms and moved into factories, so families weren't spending all that time together anymore. And then we got domestic festivals. It may be that as we're having more pressures on family life, that domestic festivals become more important. And this is probably why we see Christmas becoming such a big event, more and more pressure put on Christmas to solve the emotional tensions in families by having this great occasion when everybody comes together. So I think that a domestic festival for Purim is a good thing. At the same time, I think that the community center festivals that have emerged for Hanukkah give intermarried families a way to do something for those holidays that doesn't put pressure on their domestic life, which might be a little uncomfortable to do things at home. And this way they can go outside the home and do things and bring the relatives and do it together. So I think that there's a place for both in the home and out of the home, but I think that the community center rather than the synagogue, if you want to develop new rituals, would be more useful.
It's so interesting, because as I was hearing you talk about that change, right, the earlier point that you were making about the home becoming even more precious because it's so harried and busy and people are on different schedules and there's even less home time available. So, you know, people may not want to always deploy it on a Jewish ritual, that maybe, as you, I think we're alluding to, that the few Jewish rituals, let's say Hanukkah and Passover, where there does seem to be some willingness and some resonance to have a significant home-based Jewish ritual, maybe those become our major holidays in that sense of the sort of the pilgrimage, right? The idea that these are the holidays in which we really collect everybody together and emphasize. And it really is this question about how do holidays move from being major to minor and from being minor to major. And it makes me wonder about, well, maybe a lot of these other holidays like Purim, for example, or Shavuot or Sukkot, you know, that have a lot of really interesting dimensions to them, but maybe for this reason or another are unrealistic that they're going to become these major holidays, home-based or otherwise, then maybe our technologies that are available to us in the 21st century provide the road that we can explore. I mean, one of the things that we've been really struck by in doing this podcast over the last 8 or 9 months has been the realization that what a lot of people are appreciating about it is that it allows them to have a significant Jewish conversation, a significant Jewish thought time on their own schedule, you know, and that it's time shiftable. And that's what technology allows in a way that it's never really allowed before, unless you wanted to take a book with you.
Actually, I was just thinking about that before the conversation. Yeah, that I think we are really in a new technological era. And as technology changes, the way we live changes. For me, the great thing about the web technology and social media is that it allows people to connect in new ways on their time and where previously you hadn't connected at all. It hadn't been possible. And this is really wonderful. So I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to find new ways to make these connections. And I think you're right that it's very likely, it would seem to me, that these will enable different kinds of holiday celebrations. Certainly, at the minimum, certainly, you know, FaceTime with or Skype at Passover Seders and Hanukkah celebrations with people who are away. This would be, you know, fabulous.
We've spent a lot of time talking about the effect of the digital world on Jewish life, but one thing I didn't really think about is as we're talking about Hanukkah, I have actually Skyped in with a few friends of mine who live all around the country now. We used to live in the same place. And we've chosen Hanukkah as our time when we're going to sort of Skype into each other, reconnect. We could have chosen whatever holiday we wanted to, but we chose Hanukkah. And you know, without really deliberating about other ones, that's just what we went with. And I think that once again reflects something about this, something that we've just internalized about the nature of Hanukkah and sharing with our families or with others that we care about, that we chose that one. So I share your hope in a broad sense that the digital world of Judaism will continue to grow and thrive. But yeah, I think it's fascinating that Hanukkah in particular has been a place where maybe there can be extra growth.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. And, you know, especially because there are so many people in the Jewish community today who scoff at Hanukkah still. Oh, It's not important. It's only important because of advertising and Christmas. No, there's a lot going on here.
Well, thank you so much for joining Judaism Unbound. This has been a great conversation, and we really appreciate you coming to join us.
Thank you. I've really had a good time. You've asked much more interesting questions than I'm used to.
Well, we really appreciate hearing that. Your answers that you provided were incredibly stimulating and really thought-provoking for us as we try to think through what Hanukkah means now and what it could mean in the future. So thanks again to Diane Ashton for coming onto the show. We want to close out, as we always do, by encouraging our listeners to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First is through our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second is through our website, judaismunbound.com. And third, you can reach us via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And last but not least, we always like to give a plug for donating to support our work. And you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.